COVID vaccines going into more arms on the city's north side. Homeless people getting off the streets of downtown Jacks and into hotels thanks to a new city effort. And Dr. Fauci says don't have a big Super Bowl party this weekend when you cheer on Tampa Bay. Some of the stories making headlines this week. And good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Give us a call now. Join the conversation. It's 549-2937. Then later, why the Donna Marathon will look a whole lot different this year. But first, it is Friday, and here to discuss a very busy week in the news, we welcome our newest colleague, reporter Sydney Bowles of WJCT. Hey, Sydney.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Writer-journalist Shelton Hull. Hi, Shelton.
Good morning.
Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Good morning, Ann.
Hi, Melissa.
And rounding out our foursome, Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Hi, Nate.
Hi, Melissa.
So good to have all of you with us. Lots to get into this week, and we'll go to your calls in a moment. Already getting your calls for our Friday show. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on Facebook. All right, we're going to begin with the latest vaccine news. The city of Jacksonville is distributing coronavirus vaccine shots today and tomorrow on a first-come, first-served basis. For senior citizens, this is happening at the Northside Clanzel T. Brown Senior Center. Now, Mayor Lenny Curry, who had previously expressed a lot of frustration with the limited doses that the city had to give out, said that this proves that when Jacksonville is given supply, it can get shots into arms efficiently. City and state officials have been drawing criticism for a while now over the first phase of the vaccine rollout that was leaving African Americans vaccinated at lower rates than whites. Sydney Bowles, you covered this. Tell us a little bit about what's happening in Jacksonville on the north side today and this weekend.
Right. So the city is going to vaccinate about 975 people over this 2-day blitz. And, you know, I will say that's compared to about 11,000 people who were vaccinated at the Lane Wiley and Mandarin Senior Centers previously. And of course, those are sort of located in majority white areas. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's, you can take that a couple of different ways, right? We had folks noting that those are smaller numbers, but also we had, you know, we had the mayor and council members like Brenda Priestley Jackson saying that it's a good start and it's important to, you know, to start somewhere.
You know, just the other day on this program, we spoke with Dr. Rogers Kane, a family physician who practices on the north side. And he talked about how critical it is to get more vaccines to African-American neighborhoods. Here's Dr. Kane.
I would like to have our community leaders, the city council, and others to vocalize their concern, much like they did with Lot J, in terms of helping this community. So if we can recruit them in terms of making sure that the vaccine distribution occurs within the north side as well as other sides of town, we would much appreciate it.
Yeah. What about that, Shelton Hull? You know, Publix stores are vaccination sites because they tend to have a lot of pharmacy access. Of course, that has drawn criticism because Publix stores don't typically locate in food deserts and in convenient neighborhoods for people in some of the older city core neighborhoods, and particularly people that don't have access to transportation.
Yeah, and also Publix has donated money to conservative political candidates, which I think is drawing a comparison that is maybe not fair to them. You know, with this whole situation, governors and mayors around the country are playing catch up in terms of distributing to their populations in general, and the racial disparities unfortunately have proven pretty consistent in cities large and small around the country. I think Mr. Curry is doing a little bit better than most. You think of a city with the types of physical dimensions and these pockets of the community where people are, you know, cut off. Let's say, for example, if our public transportation system, not that it's not good, but improvements in the public transportation system would increase the ability to get this vaccine or previously to get testing available to members of the community they're perhaps underserved. Mm-hmm. Hopefully this becomes a lesson moving forward, and this pandemic is not ending anytime soon. So there's plenty of opportunity for mayors and governors around the country to get on top of this. Every day, every week presents new opportunities to serve the people.
Now, again, if you're going to come out to the Clansel T. Brown Senior Center today or tomorrow to be vaccinated, it's first come, first serve. They're going to vaccinate just under 1,000 people. Bring a photo ID and a signed copy of the screening consent form. They will have paper copies on site if you don't have internet access. Ann Schindler, First Coast News. At the same time, we're hearing Southeastern Grocers, in other words, Winn-Dixie, along with Walmart's and Sam's Clubs, will also start making vaccines available at their pharmacies. This is through the U.S. Federal Retail Pharmacy Program. The Biden administration just unveiled this. Publix is part of this as well. It kind of begs the question, why wasn't this done months ago?
Well, you know, part of this rollout of this vaccine has been that there has been so little ability to forecast, you know, when the vaccines are going to be available, what kind of supplies the state's going to get. And, you know, that is a hallmark of an effort that is not being directed with any sort of continuity nationwide, which is hopefully something that will begin to change. But, you know, you look at the distribution through grocery stores, which is, I think, going to penetrate more communities if it is grocery stores beyond Publix, which obviously have a much wider and much more, much wealthier footprint in the state. But it does speak to, too, like why the health department itself hasn't been able to kind of coordinate on the ground level. I mean, in any pandemic or any epidemiological crisis, you know, the health department has typically been the lead agency. And, mm-hmm. you know, what you've seen on the county level is not only just a complete lack of access, and I'm speaking as a reporter, you just simply can't get people from the health department to comment, to explain, to go on television and talk about the illness or how to, you know, get vaccinated. So, you know, handing it off to private business like Publix is kind of a strange makeshift solution to something that you would think could be handled on the state level or on the county level by the State Department of Health.
Yeah, Nate Monroe, Florida Times Union, county health departments are chronically underfunded. Under the DeSantis administration, all control has been centralized out of Tallahassee. Ann is right. The county health directors have effectively been muzzled. They don't have adequate resources to deal with this. This pandemic has really cast a spotlight on this problem that we don't have a robust public health system in this state.
We don't. And as like much else with the pandemic, I mean, that's also indicative of a larger national problem. You know, to give the city officials and the mayor some credit, I mean, we're talking about 1,000 doses at a time, you know, in a city of more or less 1 million people. I mean, they are kind of doing the best that they can with the really slow trickle of vaccines that are coming in, which is at the moment really the biggest problem. I mean, it's really sort of mind-blowing in a way to think about just how much we're struggling with the production and the distribution part of this. It's you know, it's pretty frightening.
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate last mile problem. I mean, Shelton Hull, you know, Operation Warp Speed under the Trump administration did receive praise for the rapid development of the vaccine products that we have. And now we are looking at this just horrible mess of efficiently distributing the product, getting enough of the population vaccinated. It's encouraging to hear other pharmaceutical giants like Johnson & Johnson. They're about to introduce their vaccine. AstraZeneca has a vaccine. I mean, this can't come fast enough. It's really frustrating to see that we allegedly, you know, the most powerful, most developed country on earth, we can't get the vaccinations out in an efficient, rapid manner quickly enough.
Yeah, you know, there was a time in this country when government agencies would give nicknames to their little special projects, and those nicknames were actually an indicator of their performance, not as in the case of, say, Warp Speed, where the title is sort of bitterly ironic and, you know, perhaps legally suspect down the road. The thing that's made Warp Speed successful, this development successful, is actually kind of a conservative principle, the idea of government staying back and let the private sector do their thing without the, you know, the as intense a regulatory process. We all know that over the last few years, Big Pharma has been the villain time after time after time after time after time after time. But in this case, in a moment of real crisis for the country, Big Pharma did step up and they did get, you know, these testing kits and these vaccines, you know, ready on a very rapid rate. But now at this point, it comes back to state, local, federal government, and of course, other parts of the private sector to get this distributed. You know, it's not, you know, Pfizer, Moderna, all of them, it's not their responsibility to get this vaccine into the arms of our most vulnerable citizens. And this is an opportunity for leaders to either lead or not lead.
Under the Trump administration and Schindler, everything was thrown to the states. Now, under President Joe Biden, there will be more of a coordinated federal response. At least that's what they're saying. What are your thoughts about this change and what it might mean?
Well, I mean, hopefully it will lead in terms of redirecting some of these vaccines to communities that are in greater need. I mean, it is no surprise, you know, it's not a new piece of information that minority communities, that black and brown communities are more imperiled by this illness and sicker, made sicker by this illness. And so the fact that we're, you know, sort of just now getting together, a location that would, you know, kind of target communities in Jacksonville of color is, seems late, you know, but that again is because there hasn't been directive top down. I mean, we've seen that with this pandemic at every step, not just with the vaccines, but with mask mandates that are undermined by the state or, you know, other safety initiatives, you know, limited capacity at restaurants and bars. I mean, the things that the locals sort of recognize needs to be done, you know, they find their hands are tied because the state hasn't given that guidance. And I think the state hasn't given that guidance because it's a political nightmare to be, you know, shutting down businesses and, you know, limiting economic opportunities. So, you know, when you have some cover, which the state has not provided local governments, presumably the federal initiative will provide some cover for the hard decisions that are going to have to be made both at the state and local level.
It's our Friday Media Roundtable, where we talk about the biggest stories of the week. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Join us at 549-2937. All right, let's talk about a related story this week. Now, we've been going through a bit of a cold snap here in North Florida as a homeless tent city has continued to grow in downtown Jacksonville. Research shows more people that are unhoused is not only bad for them, it's bad for all of us in this pandemic. It does increase the transmission of COVID-19. It does increase hospitalizations and deaths. So Jacksonville Mayor Curry announced Wednesday there's a new initiative to help the downtown homeless population. Now, this initiative is called Pathway to Home. The mayor says it's the city's most comprehensive effort yet to address Jacksonville's homeless problem and get them into rapid rehousing. Cindy Funkhauser, the president and CEO of the Sulzbacher Center, says rapid rehousing is the goal within 30 days. People are going to be put into hotel rooms, given food, mental health resources, other support. And this is, you know, something that advocates for the homeless have been asking for years. I guess it took a pandemic and a huge tent city for it to happen. Yesterday, we spoke with Dr. Guri Dirmalia from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation about how dangerous evictions are in this pandemic. Here's Dr. Malia.
And if we think about housing in particular, data has shown that people across the country may owe upwards of $70, $80 billion in back rent.
$70 to $80 billion in back rent. Sydney Bowles, that's a price tag that is never going to be fully paid. Tell us a little bit more about what's happening in Jacksonville with the Pathway to Home effort.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a culmination of a several month long effort by the city to address downtown homelessness. And it seems like they're using what's widely considered to be best practices in the homeless service community, which is, you know, address housing first and the rest will follow. Because, you know, there's a continuum of folks who find themselves homeless. If you have trouble paying your rent, it's going to be a while before you find yourself in a tent, you know, in somewhere like our downtown tent city communities. And so there are going to be a lot of overlapping issues that folks are facing there. By putting folks up in hotels, you give them a little bit of certainty and stability to maybe find work or find more stable work or, you know, focus more on food or mental health issues or addiction or other challenges. And so the hope is that by giving folks that stability and then other layers of support, the city can effectively help these folks get back on their feet for the long term.
Yeah. Nate Monroe, you've been a frequent critic of Mayor Lenny Curry. What are your thoughts about his support of this rapid rehousing effort for homeless people in Jacksonville?
You know, like, I think it's a good thing that the mayor responded to, you know, the reports about these tent cities fairly quickly. And, you know, I know they say this has been something they've been thinking about for months, but like, it's a good thing, right? I think the bigger sort of crux of the issue, however, is that we've seen these initiatives come and go in the city in the past. You know, a previous mayor set up a homeless day resource center that just kind of went away. And I think even outside the context of the pandemic, the bigger problem the city has with homelessness and with a lot of other issues is just this constant, like, wartime footing. We're just always extremely reactive to problems, and it's because we don't have the kind of funding systems set up in the city. We are chronically underfunded. And, you know, so I'm a little skeptical about, like, the long-term prospects of addressing homelessness and of this program in particular. But, you know, we'll see. Again, it's a good thing that they're doing this. And I just hope that, you know, it is a rare case where this program, you know, is continuously funded and remains in existence in perpetuity, but we'll see.
Right. Shelton, once this crisis passes, will we see a return to the default for Jacksonville, or will there be more of a strategic effort to get at some of these systemic issues that we have?
Well, I think yes and no. First of all, it's not entirely Jacksonville's fault. In my opinion, I believe that the United States in general has, you know, willfully and deliberately maintained a kind of permanent underclass in this nation for a very long time. You know, the way we treat the homeless, they've been ridiculed, they've been the butt of jokes, they've had programs defunded, they've been subject to violence from everything from drunken thugs to serial killers. And over this time, the process has grown. The homeless population now in America, compared to, say, 1980, it vastly exceeds the increase of the population. In states like Florida, you know, our homeless population is even disproportionate because of our warm weather, our access to the coast and stuff like that. We don't know what will happen next. I will say that if City Hall wants to get in, you know, all in on this, like Nate says, and truly commit to those funding mechanisms, we have a number of great organizations and a lot of very talented, very smart people working, you know, putting their lives into helping these people. And so the answers are there, not just in America, but around the country. If government and the people want to get in and do it, the homeless population can be fixed rapidly. It can, you know, rapid response is a thing that can be done. It sucks that it took the pandemic to kind of create a critical mass and, you know, some of the crime and things like that. But Now we see the problem, and we have the option of at least trying to fix it.
Yeah, and Schindler, people that work on homeless issues have been saying this for years. Rapid rehousing is the solution, and it, you know, it's taken so much for governments to get on board with this.
Yeah, it's. I mean, sadly, homelessness is, you know, one of the most solvable problems, right? I mean, the solution to homelessness is a home, and it's, you know, getting people off the street not only keeps them safer, but it gives them, you know, stability to solve their problems if they've got them with, you know, addiction or other problems. It gives them a place to get clean and warm. I mean, it's kind of obvious that it's really hard to do things like get jobs or have family stability when you're living on the street. And a house is the cheapest and easiest way to solve a raft of problems. But, you know, it's ironic that the pandemic has, I mean, while there's been this limit on evictions, the pandemic has forced the homeless shelters to essentially, you know, evict at least half of their potential clientele because they've had to slim down what is safe indoors and not house as many people. So, I mean, hopefully getting, you know, this is a start. The question that I have and always have about the, you know, this kind of is what are the rules going to be, right? I mean, there are people who are homeless and have issues with addiction, and there are people who are homeless who have issues with, you know, a history of, you know, some offenses, and trying to find housing for people without putting a lot of restrictions on them that makes them somehow ineligible or unwilling to be housed is important. So, you know, you kind of got to balance that. A lot of times shelters, you know, will turn away people because they don't have, you know, they're not willing to, for instance, commit to sobriety. And that's a tough thing that, you know, that's a whole other problem that really cannot be tackled until people have some safe place to be.
Yeah. And Sydney Bowles, before we move on to some other topics, let's also touch on the fact that getting people off the streets is good for ending, bringing about a more rapid end to this pandemic. As we've learned this week, there's a lot of research to show that more people that are not housed on our streets will only contribute to more transmission, more hospitalizations, and more deaths.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems to be a pretty cost-effective solution, not only in terms of practices around rapid rehousing and housing first policies, but keeping folks off the street means fewer people in emergency rooms, less traffic in homeless shelters. It seems like an all-around good call.
It's our Friday roundtable. The biggest stories of the week, give us a call. It's 549-2937. As we move on now with Nate Monroe, Ann Schindler, Shelton Hull, Sydney Bowles, and yours truly, and talk about another big story from the week. This is really a head-scratcher. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is drawing accusations of severely misplaced priorities. Of course, as we've been talking about for a half hour now, we're in the middle of a pandemic, a homeless crisis, widespread unemployment. But the governor says his biggest priority is a new piece of legislation called the Transparency in Technology Act. We won't say the acronym out loud on the radio, although there was a lot of hilarity about that the other day. The governor says it's a tool to fight big tech and the alleged discrimination of sites such as Twitter, silencing conservative voices. Of course, former President Trump was very prominently banned from Twitter after the January 6th insurrection attempt at the Capitol. Okay, Nate Monroe, you've been writing about this in the Times Union. You call this performative, largely unenforceable, almost certainly unconstitutional, a piece of legislative theater. What is happening with the governor that he considers this attack on big tech sites and social media sites to be so important given all of the other public health problems and economic problems that we have here in Florida right now?
Well, I mean, you know, and to tie this to what we've been talking about for the past half hour, I mean, I think that the governor's office and the state's response or lack of a response to the pandemic to some degree reflect what appears to be a deeply held belief by the governor that the pandemic is just really not that big a deal. He has telegraphed from the beginning that he thinks COVID is not as serious as a lot of the nation's public health experts do. he has prioritized sort of political grandstanding over legitimate responses. And this social media thing is all just about preening for the state's newest resident in Trump. I mean, it's you know, Trump's already had COVID. Trump was fired from his job for cause. So, you know, he's not worried about unemployment. He's not worried about getting COVID again. He's worried about being banned from Twitter. And that's what Ron DeSantis cares about. And this bill is theater. The particulars of the bill are not super important. It's all just sort of trying to send a message and almost propaganda-like. It's just nonsense.
You also noted that the governor, while he's putting forth this legislation, isn't pushing for Florida to divest itself of the $8 billion it holds in tech stocks. So,
the bill is supposed to be useless by design.
So is the governor positioning himself through this assault on big tech for a run for president in a few years? He's going to have some stiff competition on the right. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, there have been calls to expel him from the Senate. He lost a book contract for a book he wanted to write called The Tyranny of Big Tech in the wake of the Capitol siege. But this is the kind of culture war issue that base voters in a Republican primary will certainly warm to.
Of course. And, you know, the irony is that for all the complaining that folks like Josh Hawley and Ron DeSantis do about, you know, being quote unquote canceled, for some reason, we just seem to not be able to stop talking about them. I mean, they have not been canceled. They get constant attention.
Shelton Hall, let's talk about that for a minute. And let us know, folks,
yes,
what you think about the governor's assault on big tech. Do you think big tech needs to be reined in? Do you think big tech is biased against conservative voices? Call us 549-2937. This whole notion of cancel culture, Senator Hawley said he was canceled when a private company declined to honor its book contract with him. He's not being canceled. He's free to seek another contract with another company. What about this whole red meat issue of cancel culture?
Oh yeah, I've been hankering to chew this particular piece of fat for
okay.
a little while now.
Then chew away.
But let me start out by saying that Josh Hawley is a traitor and a psychopath and isn't worthy of being mentioned in the same breath as Ron DeSantis, who at least has like some fundamental morals. And it's like, I think at heart, a decent person. But this situation, really, the operative word is self-care, because Ron DeSantis in 2020 had the worst year perhaps of any governor in Florida history. And as we've all seen throughout the spectrum of life, undiagnosed trauma leads to bad decisions. Is this gesture performative? Sure. Is it silly? Sure. Is it, you know, nonsensical? Sure. But it's also poorly timed. It's a lot like the legislation or the thing he was talking about to increase penalties on protesters last year. It's pandering, and it's poorly timed pandering. He's investing political capital in a program whose acronym can't even be said on TV. Like it creates jokes. It's like when Nixon's committee to reelect the president, aka CREEP. With this situation, I don't see what the point of it is. I don't know. It's just a really, I think he's had a rough year, and I don't think he has. His wife is a friend. They're good people, but It's much like the president. Like he's rapidly putting himself in a situation where he could cost his party the state legislature in 2022. You know, more incidents like this. Like, he doesn't need to pander to the red meat crowd. The red meat crowd has nowhere to go but to support him. They have to do what he says no matter what. But, you know, look what happened to Trump. How many Republicans lost their political careers simply because of the blowback of being associated with things like this? He shouldn't be talking about Trump and the social media stuff. It's toxic. It's he gets no benefit from it, just as he got no benefit from trying to, trying to get aggressive with the Black Lives Matter protesters last year. Why was he doing that in a state that had a whole lot less drama with the Black Lives Matter protests than they had in other cities? You know, he has this sense of jumping on it, like it's sort of like I saw this on TV 2 weeks ago, so now I'm going to say something about it when everybody's already moved on to a different subject. It's weird, and I worry for him on a human level.
549-2937. It's our Friday media roundtable as we talk about vaccination efforts in Jacksonville, efforts to get the homelessness off local streets. Here's an email from Clyde. Please point out the Beaches Ministry has been working for years with those in danger of losing their homes, paying utility bills, rent, mortgage payments, and finding them long-term solutions. Thanks for that, Clyde. Also, lots of calls as we talk about the governor's broadside against big tech with a new piece of legislation. What do you think about that? 549-2937 to give us a call. John is in Jacksonville. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you?
All right, thanks. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll make my comment and listen offline. The comment is this. I don't think the problem is with Trump and those sorts or Hawley. The problem is not with DeSantis. The problem is with our city commission, which just voted down going out on a limb with my tax money in the future of $400 million for sports and entertainment things. I don't see our city commission pointed in the right way. When they're going to make debt for us, I would like them to make debt for us and improvements in this community. That has nothing to do with all the other things that we've rooted up
and
to.
And are you talking about the Lot J deal, John?
Well, yeah, that's an example I've seen. And we've given hundreds of million dollars over the 43 years I've lived here to many endeavors. And they go out with my future tax payments to pay this money back by giving breaks to wealthy people. Why are we not going out on a debt for $400 million to improve our county health service? Improve our services to the poor, improve our services to the homeless. We're not doing that. Nobody goes out on a limb with my future tax payments to the tune of hundreds of million dollars, except for rich people and endeavors that do not benefit all the community. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Ann Schindler, you know, it was exactly that kind of argument from the public that killed the Lot J deal. Voters saying, we would prefer our tax dollars to be spent on more critical needs.
Yeah, well, I mean, there really is no kind of rationale for borrowing $500 million to, you know, when there are so many needs that we already can't afford. I mean, you know, Nate kind of points this out frequently, the fact that there's not, you know, sustainable funding for basic city functions. You know, if you can't actually afford to run your government, it would seem logical to find a way to, you know, fund it on an ongoing basis so that you're not struggling to do things like keep lawns cut or, you know, give people the actual services they need. But I kind of wanted to circle back to the big tech question because, mm-hmm. I mean, I worked in a bar for a number of years and we 86 people all the time who were bad customers or obnoxious or in some way, you know, offensive to the people around them. And terms of service is very much like a restaurant being able to control its clientele. You'll see those signs. You know, we reserve the right to deny service to anybody. And that's kind of what Twitter is. You know, if you're going to be, an unpleasant customer, they have every right to send you packing. And I don't think it's any different than a bar owner being able to kick you to the curb if you're drunk or obnoxious.
That's an interesting analogy. Here's an email from a listener. Tell us who on the left, even the extreme left or openly Marxist or communist, gets canceled. Who on the left gets uninvited to speak at universities? Who on the left gets their Twitter or Facebook account canceled? This listener sees a double standard. Nate Monroe, whether or not that's true, on social media in particular, we're not really talking about university culture right now, but on the right, that is a deeply held belief. That is a very strong perception on the right that there is a double standard.
Sure. I mean, there is this really sort of odd policy goal that this very specific strain of Republican has. I mean, in essence, you know, the kind of Trump Republicans want to strip Twitter of protections they have against being sued because of things that their users say on their platform. So they want Twitter to be able to be held civilly liable for things that their users say. And at the same time, they want to prevent Twitter from kicking those users off of their platforms. And so I'm not really sure what the coherent purpose of that would be other than sort of revenge for what they anecdotally think is this double standard, which, by the way, I mean, even if it were true that there was a double standard, I mean, companies are allowed to promote a certain type of political view. Consumers of Fox News ought to know that better than anybody. I mean, it would be perfectly legal for a social media company to be set up with the aim of promoting the views of liberals over conservatives or vice versa. Again, I don't believe that's what Twitter does, but, you know, even that would be fine.
Tim on the West Side. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I just have a quick question. I'm curious if the panel could comment on what they think about the arrest of data scientist Rebecca Jones, and who exposed the manipulation of COVID data from the DeSantis team, and then, you know, subsequently had her house raided and then charged for misuse of government software. The implications of that going forward, and also just what they think the outcome of that situation will
be. Thanks, Tim. You know, Rebecca Jones was a fired Florida Department of Health data analyst. She filed a civil lawsuit saying that the FDLE and law enforcement agents violated her rights. That lawsuit has actually been moved to federal court, U.S. District Court in Tallahassee. Jones says that the FDLE violated her First Amendment and due process rights and conducted an unlawful search and seizure when they took away some computer equipment in December. Of course, she's been in the national spotlight accusing the DeSantis administration of manipulating data about the COVID pandemic. She had set up a competing COVID online dashboard to track the virus. The FDLE said she allegedly hacked into an internal Department of Health multi-user account. That's the latest on that case. And, of course, her allegations will be vetted in court. Apparently, Shelton Hall, she's left Florida and is now living in Washington. But we'll have to see how that case plays out and whether her accusations hold water. But it certainly goes along with what Nate was saying a minute ago, that it's sort of part and parcel of the troubles that Governor DeSantis has had managing the narrative of his administration's handling of this pandemic.
Yeah, I'd say I agree with most of the stuff that the caller just said. There are certain areas that you can't be talked about. Was she targeted because of her, because of the things she knew? Yes. Has the data been fudged? Yes, the data has been fudged on every level of government, you know, and in every government of the world. The whole thing is started with fudged data, you know, like the Keebler elves. But it's very weird. Not to get too weird about it, but like, she's lucky to still be alive. She could have been Karen Silkwood 6 months ago if it had been a more ruthless group of people around. I'm surprised that
that's a pretty strong accusation.
I'm not saying anyone would have done that necessarily. I'm just saying things have happened before. And if you're putting out data, say, if you're saying that, you know, as we all know, that the government failed to handle this pandemic correctly. Maybe they got the numbers wrong because there were too many numbers to take in at once, and they were going, you know, outside of their depth. Maybe it was for political gain. We don't know. But those are very inconvenient questions. The work she did, you could say that the work she did contributed in part to the Republicans losing the White House, and it could contribute in part to Republicans losing the State House in 2022. certainly it didn't help Mr. DeSantis, going back to what we were saying about all this tech overlord stuff. He's got a bone to pick with the computer industry. You know, some of this stuff has come back to burn him a few times. I'm glad she's in Washington, and I think this whole last 4 years does create challenges for whistleblowers going forward. You know, there are risks, and not everyone is as nice as Ron DeSantis when it comes to things like this.
By the way, we're getting lots of emails and tweets pointing out different progressive platforms on YouTube, Google, Twitter, Facebook that have been taken down in some form or another for violations of terms of service to push back against the idea that only conservatives face that. I won't go into all the specific examples, but all of you out there are really listening and providing some citations, so thank you for that. Okay, before we let you guys go, let's talk about the Super Bowl this weekend. Of course, Florida has a real stake in it this year, but while you root on the Buccaneers, Dr. Anthony Fauci says, please do not congregate for Super Bowl parties. The nation's top infectious disease official is begging people to break from that tradition. He's been making the media rounds and imploring people to limit their gatherings to household members only. Nate Monroe, you know, sorry to say that your team, the Saints, is not going to be in the big game. But what about this? You know, the venue in Tampa Bay is going to be filled at about one third of its capacity as they face off against the Kansas City Chiefs. So they're going to try to make the game itself a little safer than it would otherwise be. But this is another test for America, you know. Can people restrict themselves? So far, based on what we've seen from Americans throughout this pandemic, the answer is probably no.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to say, I think we know the answer to that. People are going to congregate, and they're going to act foolish, and, you know, we'll see. It seems like the national case numbers were, you know, started to decline sort of across the board a bit, and maybe that's us coming off that holiday bounce, and maybe we're just going to have another little bump in the road here. I guess we'll see.
Yeah. You know, and this is interesting too. Anheuser-Busch is not going to run its famous Clydesdale type ad during the game. Instead, they're going to run something that's more like a PSA celebrating American resilience in the face of the pandemic and ending with scenes of people being vaccinated. The Super Bowl is such a national communal event, but this year it will be different in the context of the times we're in.
I mean, I guess there is a sense, you know, even on the part of big, you know, advertisers to try to convey some sense of the gravity of the time and not seem too, I don't know, celebratory. You know, I think that people are just conscious of their, how they come across. But, I mean, it's, you know, the Super Bowl is, I mean, you're talking to probably like the one person in America who's not really going to watch the Super Bowl. So, like, I understand that people enjoy it. I'm not one of them, but, you know, it is obviously a time where, like, they have more eyes than they ever will. So if they're trying to convey something about their priorities or their policies, you know, the Super Bowl's the time to do it.
Okay. Shelton Hull, you're a football fan. This is the first time
Yes.
a team has played a Super Bowl in its home stadium. That's something to celebrate, too.
Absolutely. And only in Florida, you know, it's a great time of year for football fans here because, you know, every few years, like the Harvest Moon or Halley's Comet, you will find someone in Florida that manages to play football successfully. It's been a beautiful thing. The fact that Florida could get Tom Brady, you know, one of the great villains of NFL history, down to Tampa, turn him into Florida man with a former Jaguar as the offensive coordinator and a former Jaguar in the backfield and run the table all the way to a Super Bowl in Tampa in the middle of a pandemic, and I'm pretty sure they're going to win, and then Tampa's going to party. You see
aren't
what Tampa's...
Aren't the Chiefs favored, though?
The Chiefs are favored, but it's Tom Brady in Tampa. Like, it's, I mean, there's going to be a lot of chads hanging, and I'm not talking about ballots. If they win this game, they're going to be, you know, and now you got to worry about these Tampa fans turning over trash cans in the middle of a pandemic. Then you're burning trash and you're burning cars and jumping around. And, you know, you got to wear your mask. You know,
while you're
with
destroying public property. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, however you spend your Super Bowl Sunday, try to follow that sound advice from Dr. Fauci. Don't go to a big Super Bowl party. Don't be a dummy like that, everybody. And thank you, Shelton Hull, so much. I neglected to mention Shelton is now host of The Contrast Project on YouTube. Check that out. Also, Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union, Ann Schindler of First Coast News, and Sydney Bowles of WJCT. Thanks so much, everyone, and have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In a moment, a preview of the Donna Marathon, going virtual this year. We'll be right back.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
Infections, deaths, and hospitalizations due to COVID-19 are all down from earlier record highs. That doesn't mean you can have your friends around this weekend.
Watch the Super Bowl on TV, enjoy it, lay low and cool it.
The GOP wrestles with an identity crisis as Donald Trump's new legal team gets ready for his second impeachment trial. It's the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Well, the Donna Marathon is right around the corner, but this year it's going virtual due to the pandemic. You can get out and run, though, and take part. Donna Deegan, the namesake and founder of the Donna Foundation, which this event benefits, is on the line now. Hey, Donna.
Good morning, Melissa. I'm sorry I'm not there with you in person this year.
I know, and I'm sorry that we have to do it this way. Of course, the marathon will be virtual as well this year, but still lots of exciting things that have opened up this Donna experience to even more people. Tell us how people can participate in the marathon.
Well, the great thing is if people want to run for time, they can do that. They can upload their time by the end of February 14th, which is actually officially marathon day, or they can run their race, run overtime. So what I tell people is, hey, if you want to go out and walk a mile a day for 26 days and get your marathon medal, go for it. I mean, this year you can do it your way. So it gives people an opportunity to earn a marathon medal who might have never had an opportunity to do that. And that's one of the nice things. Also, Melissa, as you know, we've taken our expo online. We're having a Fearless series, and you're actually one of our hosts for that, which we're excited about.
That's
you're
right.
Hosting a panel on clinical trials and health equity. And as you know, health equity is just such a big topic right now and really important. But all sorts of wonderful topics there, financial toxicity, how you can get involved in health policy, how you can figure out how to get assistance. I mean, there's all sorts of great things people can tune into that online series for, as well as run if they'd like to do that. Just ways we all can continue to connect, even though because of the pandemic, we're sort of, what we say is we're running everywhere together this year. We just can't run together, unfortunately.
That's right. And however you run or participate, you're helping support the work of the Donna Foundation. We just learned an anonymous supporter will make a $10,000 matching gift when an additional $10,000 is raised toward their $300,000 goal.
That's the 5th through the 8th. That's for the next 3 days. So it's today through the 8th. We have that opportunity to match every donation up to $10,000.
That's great. And this helps families living with breast cancer, particularly families that don't have health insurance. Now, you're going to see all kinds of pink around town, the Laura Street Lights, Daly's Place, the Acosta Bridge. Everybody is asked to decorate your yard, wear pink for Donna Marathon Week, support this whole effort. Now, of course, you run in more ways than one, Donna. I have to get political for a minute. You recently you recently ran in another context for Congress. You lost that race to Congressman John Rutherford, but that has certainly fired up a lot of speculation about your next move in the world of politics. How about breaking some news right here on this show and telling us what you have planned and if you're going to run for something else?
Well, you know what, Melissa? The moment that I know, if you remember, I actually broke the news that I was running for Congress on your show.
That's right.
And I'll tell you that the moment that I know, you will know.
Okay.
At this point, we have a 97% increase in people asking for assistance year over year, and my goal right now is to just make sure that we can ensure that those people have the help that they need. So we're fundraising for this year through March. And after that, hopefully I'll have some time to figure out where we go next in terms of the whole political scene.
But you're not ruling out another run for public office.
I'm not at all. I am very motivated to make sure that those issues, not only that I feel passionately about, but that I feel that people in this area feel passionately about are addressed. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, I think the events of the last several weeks have only served to underscore that we really need people who are willing to stand up for folks. So I'm certainly not ruling it out, but I don't know exactly what that will look like for me going forward.
And when you say
that, I'll tell you when I do, I promise.
All right. And when you say the events of the last several weeks, you're referring to the January 6th Capitol sacking?
I think that, and then, you know, frankly, the fact that we just haven't had a lot of folks who have pushed back on that that we have elected to office, including Representative Rutherford, but not just him. I think I would like to see more people stand up and say, you know what, attacks like that not only are not acceptable, but having people who are out there threatening public officials, who are out there, you know, throwing out crazy conspiracy theories. That's not who we are, and it's not who we want to be. And I'd really like to see more people stand up and say, gosh, we really do want to work together. Can we at least work together in truth and fact, as opposed to fantasy? And I'm hopeful we'll have more public officials who are willing to do that.
Well, as you said, in the meantime, the website is breastcancermarathon.com for the Donna Marathon, Everywhere Together on Valentine's Day, February 14th. but it's virtual, so go on to the website and check it out. Figure out how you
and
can
Melissa,
take part.
I have to tell you that even if you don't want to run, we always have that ever-popular 0.0 option. That will allow you to run 0.0.
That would be my option.
So please.
I think I'll take advantage of that option. A leisurely stroll. Can I do a leisurely walking of my dog? And then does that count?
It absolutely counts.
A lackadaisical 20 minutes on the Stairmaster. Would that count? Because that's about my speed.
Yes, ma'am. It all counts.
All right. Check it out. Breastcancermarathon.com. Donna Deegan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa. Have a great day.
Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is digital editor. Make sure to listen today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in program, looking at the biggest stories of the week, more about the governor's vaccination rollout efforts, and other news across the Sunshine State today at noon. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.